Mood with Kim G.C. Moody Podcast. I'm your host, Kim Moody. I'm a Canadian tax expert who has over 30 years of experience at a specialist level dealing with Canada-U.S. tax matters for the private client. For those of you who know me, I love the study of leadership. I'm passionate about entrepreneurship and how tax and economic policy impacts Canadian entrepreneurs, executives, and average Canadians. This podcast will discuss topics relating to taxation, taxation policy, leadership, economics, and the odd political comment as it relates to the previous topics, all in a lighthearted and playful style. Strap in and come along for the ride. Good day. My name is Kim Moody, and I'm your host for In the Mood with Kim G.C. Moody Podcast. And today is April the 22nd, and I'm recording this podcast 6 days after the release of the April 16th, 2024 budget. I certainly wanted to get to it before, but it's been just a flurry of activity. And so, you know, for people that have hopefully been waiting for my podcast on this topic, apologies for taking so long, but it has been rather crazy. And it's been crazy because, you know, I was on record both on this podcast and in the Financial Post and other places that I didn't think it was going to be a very tax savvy or have much to do with tax whatsoever. And boy, was I wrong. So I actually was on record saying that I doubt that the capital gains inclusion rate would increase. And because, as most listeners know, for Canadian purposes, at least anyhow, capital gains are only half taxable. That's the inclusion rate. And so if you have a $100 capital gain, you only include $50 in your income, and you'll pay marginal rates if you're an individual, or corporate rates to the extent that you're a corporation. And so in any event, that was by far the highlight measure that came out of the budget, was an increase in the capital gains inclusion rate, which we'll certainly get to. But let me just stop there for a second before I go further on capital gains inclusion rate. Let's just, you know, I'll give you my grade on what I think this overall budget is. Is it an A or A plus or a B, C, D, E? I think it's an F, and I think it's a big F. And I'm going to copy my friend, Jack Mintz, who's a preeminent economist. You know, the day after the budget was released, you know, he had an article in the National Post, or sorry, Financial Post, that graded the budget a big F for a whole variety of reasons. And certainly I follow suit with Jack Mintz's sentiments. And so let me tell you a little bit about the economics. First of all, there wasn't a day, probably within 2 weeks prior to the release of the budget, where there wasn't some sort of, you know, photo opportunity and spending announcement as it relates to housing. Because, of course, housing challenges are the flavor of the day when it comes to the recent issues. And I call it flavor of the day because some people seem to think that, you know, Canada's never had housing challenges. Well, if you go back in history, we've had housing challenges as a country for as far back as I can recall being alive. And if you study history, you'll certainly see that Canada has always had housing challenges. And so there's been economic policies and tax policies and that follow suit with respect to trying to encourage Canadians to, you know, acquire housing. But in any event, bottom line is this particular housing challenge in our country's history, in my view, is very self-inflicted. And it's self-inflicted because of the inflationary environment that we've been in, which has really driven up costs throughout, you know, the entire supply chain in our entire countries, and really driven up the cost of living overall for average Canadians, which includes rent and includes, you know, interest rates on mortgages, of course, which have gone up, which is, you know, the second challenge besides inflation is interest rates, which have made it very difficult for, you know, especially younger Canadians trying to enter the market because of price increases and mortgage rates being so high. And And so all this leads, oh, sorry, and then of course the last contributor to our housing challenges is unchecked immigration levels. Our population as a country has grown unbelievably fast. And simply, it's because of unchecked immigration. Most of the population increase, a substantial portion of it, vast majority is because of immigration, and it's been unchecked. And so those three things that, in my view, have led to a self-inflicted housing crisis, which apparently needs government intervention in a big way in order to, right the ship, if you want to call it. And when you say government intervention, substitute that phrase for spending. I think ultimately, if we can get government spending under control, that'll lead to presumably lower interest rates, and ultimately less deficits, which contribute to high inflationary environments and high interest rates. And at the same time, of course, reduce our immigration levels, because if we don't have housing or affordable housing to provide to our new immigrants, then what's the point? We want our immigrants to be successful when they come to Canada. So those three things, in my view, need to get under control rather than just spend, spend, spend. And so with the tax measures as it came to housing, there really wasn't a lot. There's some increased CCA rate, capital cost allowance rate, which is the tax depreciation, increase from 4% to 10% for new eligible so-called purpose-built rental projects, as long as they start after budget date and available within a certain period of time. We have the withdrawal limit for the RSP Home Buyers Plan increased from 35,000 to 60,000, and a temporary increase to the repayment grace period to 5 years. That's not a bad plan, because the RSP Home Buyers Withdrawal Plan has been around for a long time, and I think it's certainly helped younger Canadians enter the market. Certainly helped me probably 3 decades ago, and so nice to see that. There's some interest deductibility relief for certain purpose-built rental, very technical, I won't get into it. And then there's a new consultation on a future new federal vacant residential land tax. Oh, great. Anytime you see the phrase consultation, you know that there's going to be some more damage coming down the pipe. And so with that, that was pretty much all the housing tax measures in the budget. But on the economic side, just to get to that, it was spend, spend, spend. We have no fiscal anchor. The government made apparently they were supposed to get patted on the back for keeping the deficit to $40 billion or less. I mean, that's a big number, 40 billion. But of course they did that, and I'll have more to say on that. But unfortunately, our public debt charges are scheduled to increase to 54.1 billion for the coming year. Think about that, 54.1 billion. That's over $1 billion per week that Canadians are spending for public debt charges that have no societal benefit whatsoever. In other words, we're not getting health care, we're not getting roads, et cetera. It just is being paid to the debt holders for no societal benefit. And according to the projections in the budget, in 2028, 29, those debt charges are scheduled to increase to 64.3 billion. And frankly, I don't believe that. I think, with this government's track record, assuming it sticks around for the next couple of years, it's going to be higher than that, in my view. And so, those are the economic summary comments that I have. It's not well thought out in terms of economics. And so I really do worry about our future economic fiscal policies. What was not in the budget? I mean, there was a lot of, especially the day before, there was some so-called leaks, which really drives me crazy, because apparently budget secrecy is not sacrosanct anymore. But there was a leak that we're going to see an attack on the wealthy vis-a-vis tax increases, and I'll get to that in a minute, because ultimately that turned out to be the increase in the capital gains inclusion rate. There was some worries, and I was on record on this in the Financial Post. I thought they might attack the energy industry, or maybe even the grocery industry, because of the Liberals' coalition partner always on the attack on the evil grocery companies that are apparently making way too much profits. I thought they might introduce some excess profits tax, but thankfully there wasn't. And then there were some prognosticators that suggested they're going to, you know, finally introduce a wealth tax. And I didn't see it coming. And sure enough, it's not in the budget, which if they would have done that, that would have been quite poor policy. There was a significant amount of ink spilled in the budget documents on how important entrepreneurs are. And, you know, that always, especially this current government, puts me on edge. And because, you know, I honestly don't believe that they believe that entrepreneurs are the backbone of the country. But what they did is they introduced a so-called Canada Entrepreneurs Incentive, and which I'll talk about that in 2 seconds here. And then they introduced an increase to the lifetime capital gains exemption. Currently, it's about $1,016,000 for people that dispose of qualified small business corporation shares or qualified farming or fishing property. But they've increased that to $1.25 million starting June the 25th forward, June the 25th of 2024, and indexation will resume in 2027. And so I thought, I wonder what this is about. Maybe they are actually going to incentivize entrepreneurs to take more risk. And then they followed up with some announcements about the conditions, because they had announced a $10 million exemption for transfers to an employee ownership trust at the fall economic statement of 2023. But they didn't release any details at that time, but the details are now released in the federal budget. We don't have much legislation on any of these proposals, just simply comments in the budget documents. So let me take a step back and just talk quickly about the Canada, there's the so-called new Canadian Entrepreneurs Incentive. And so what that apparently is if you sell shares of a company, and then there's, you know, very specific restrictions in terms of what type of share, so-called founder shares, which I don't really understand what that means. But because there's no legislation, but if you meet a long list of conditions, then you'll apparently be able to have a $2 million exemption. And this is in addition to the capital gains deduction and to the employee ownership $10 million exemption as well. But it's not an outright exemption. What this is it reduces the capital gains inclusion rate to one-third as opposed to the normal rule of two-thirds, which I'll get into this in more of a minute here. And so basically it's an incentive because you're going to pay tax on less capital gains included in your income. But it's not an outright exemption like it is on the lifetime capital gains deduction. The issue with the so-called Canada Entrepreneurs Incentive, though, as you read the documents, is that, okay, if you can meet it, that's not bad. But buried in the documents is the prohibition of the types of industries that you cannot be in order to get eligibility. So let me just read to you what these are. So the share does not represent a direct or indirect interest in a professional corporation. Okay, so accountants like me are out, lawyers are out, doctors are out. A corporation whose principal asset is the reputation or skill of one or more employees. Okay, so any corporation who has some significant goodwill or reputational type assets, you're out. Or a corporation that carries on the business in the financial, insurance business, you're out. Real estate business, food and accommodation, you're out. Arts, recreation, or entertainment sector, you're out. Consulting or personal care services sector, you're out. All right, well, think about that long list for a second. That's a long list of industries. What's remaining? Well, technology. and maybe some other ones that you might be able to dream up. Like, for example, they use the phrase real estate here, but I don't really know what that means. Like, is construction type industries okay? Trades, are they okay? My guess is once the detailed legislation is released, if it ever is, that it will be okay because they probably won't encourage housing, but don't know. And so technology certainly is the obvious. And I'm not sure why they would have, provided a long list of exceptions as opposed to just simply saying, hey, we want to encourage technology companies. And if you do, then we'll give you a lower capital gains inclusion rate. The other killer on this is that they say that it's a $2 million incentive. It's a lifetime incentive, so it's cumulative. But it's only phased in $200,000 per year starting next year. And so by the time this is phased in fully, it'll be 2034. And I presume we're long, we'll have the existing government will be long gone. And so query whether or not this particular proposal survives. I tend to think it won't. Quite frankly, it's rather silly. Let's go to the employee ownership trust stuff real quick before I get to the highlight material. And so fast forward, sorry, look back a few budgets ago. I can't exactly remember which budget it was, but there is an introduction of this concept called employee ownership trust that ultimately the government was exploring the use of employee ownership trust to help entrepreneurs succeed their business to, to employees. In the 2023 budget, they finally released some details. And the details were rather scary, if you want to call it that, because ultimately, in order to get benefits, and the benefits were rather sparse, and I won't even get into that, you basically had to, you as the entrepreneur, had to give up complete legal and factual control to this new employee ownership trust of which you're not a part of, and you can't control it whatsoever as the entrepreneur or even have some influence. And given that it's a new trust, the new trust likely won't have any cash. And so ultimately, it's going to use future profits to pay off the entrepreneur. So think about that from a commercial perspective. Who in their right mind as an entrepreneur would ultimately sell for very little tax benefit, but lots of economic and commercial risks? Not a lot. So fast forward to the 2023 fall economic statement, and obviously the government heard this, and so they wanted to add a sweetener. And the sweetener was, okay, entrepreneurs, if you do this, then we'll give you a $10 million capital gains exemption for any gains up to $10 million that you realize on the transfer. Well, that's a pretty big sweetener, at least from the sounds of it. But they didn't release any details, and so the issue, before getting the details, was okay. Let's think about this. Me as the entrepreneur, I could trigger a $10 million gain, and yeah, I've got a lot of commercial risk. But boy, the tax benefit is pretty big here. I wonder what the details are. So the details are released in the 2024 budget documents, and sure enough, it's still very, very restrictive in terms of eligibility. In other words, you have to give up complete legal and factual control. I was hopeful that they would soften that. And so that's probably the short story. There's a lot more detail in the budget documents, but the bottom line is that I don't see much pickup on this whatsoever, because ultimately, even though the government clearly wants to encourage employees to buy businesses, I mean, that's a very left-leaning social policy objective, but ultimately it clashes with the commercial risk that entrepreneurs would need to inherit. I'm not sure why, if they really want to encourage employee ownership, which I don't think there's anything wrong with employee ownership, but I also don't think there's anything wrong with entrepreneurs being involved in an employee ownership type structure. I don't understand why they wouldn't have allowed partial ownership by the entrepreneur and partial control. Like, why so extreme that the entrepreneur cannot be involved? I don't get that. Because in my view, the entrepreneur is likely in the best case or the best circumstances in order to try to mitigate commercial risk and help the employees transition. So until that issue is dealt with, I am very doubtful that this $10 million exemption will be enough of a sweetener to get that over the goal line. So let's talk now about the highlight proposal, which is the capital gains inclusion rate. And like I mentioned, I was wrong on this one. I thought that the government would not increase the capital gains inclusion rate from 50% to something larger, because there's been lots of prognosticators throughout the years that have predicted there is going to be a capital gains inclusion rate. And of course, sure enough, it never came to fruition. And the last time the government screwed around with capital gains inclusion rate was in the year 2000, so 24 years ago, when the Liberal government at that time reduced the capital gains inclusion rate. And they actually reduced it twice, but ultimately it started at 75% in that year of an inclusion rate and dropped it to two-thirds, and then later in the year, in October of 2000, dropped it to 50%. And it's been at that 50% level ever since to present day. And so, for the last 24 years, we've had, prognosticators, like I've said, that have rang the alarm bell and cried wolf. And I just didn't like being part of that because I didn't see any great policy reasons for increasing the capital gains inclusion rate. But sure enough, this government has increased it all under the guise of, which I'll talk more about the messaging here shortly, but all under the guise of getting the rich to pay their fair share and just to pay a little bit more, which is ridiculous. But I'll give you a little more detail on that. And so the way that the rule is proposed to work is effective June the 25th, so about 10 weeks from the budget announcement date, it will increase from 50% to two-thirds across the board for corporations and trusts. But for individuals, they get the first $250,000 of realized capital gains or deemed dispositions at the lower inclusion rate of 50%, and anything in excess of $250,000 annually is at the two-thirds rate. So, query, why a difference between individuals versus corporations and trusts? Because obviously in this case, the government looks at corporations and trusts as being, in quotations, air quotes, evil. Why would they not put them on the same footing as individuals? I have no idea why. Because by doing so, it throws off the, the concept of integration. And the concept of integration is a critical one. It basically tries to provide neutrality from a tax perspective of, where investors place their dollars. If investors place their dollars in a corporation and ultimately realize capital gains or investment income, on a flow-through basis, once they pay corporate tax and pay tax on dividends, the overall tax load should be similar or identical to what they would have paid had they just simply realized that investment income personally, if they held the investments personally. That concept of integration, it has been a foundational one in Canadian tax for decades. And there's been some economists that have called for a revisit of that foundational principle. And frankly, I don't agree with any of any propositions put forward by those left-leaning economists that think there's room to not have integration. But now, with this proposal, we don't have integration because ultimately investors or individuals in Canada will be more motivated to place their investment dollars personally as opposed to having investments inside a corporation. If you're just so damn lucky to have investments inside your company and you're going to realize capital gains in the future, well, it sucks to be you. Because after June the 24th of 2024, any capital gain realized will be at the two-thirds inclusion rate. Whereas if you had held that, those properties individually, you get the first 250 at the 50% inclusion rate. So in my view, that's just foundationally wrong and not fair. I will get just a quick throwaway comment here before I move on. The principal residence exemption, which is available for Canadian residents who only personally use property that is a capital property and they sell it for a gain, they are still eligible for the principal residence exemption. So the capital gains inclusion rate did nothing with the principal residence exemption. So just to give you a bit of math, and you know, obviously this is a podcast, and you're not going to see what I'm looking at here on the table. But just in dealing with, let's say, you've got an individual versus a corporation that has $1 million capital gain. And so, you know, with a corporation that has $1 million capital gain, under the existing rules in Ontario, your overall tax load, including what you're going to pay corporately, and then versus, and then add to that whatever tax you pay on a dividend when you flow it all the way through, you'll pay 29.0% tax overall. Now, with this two-thirds inclusion rate on the same $1 million capital gain realized after June the 24th, you're going to realize a 38.6% tax load. That's a significant increase. And so on the individual basis as well, you have an overall increase at that level, like $1 million capital gain as well. And ultimately, using the mathematics for Ontario, the overall load is 35.69%. Or sorry, that's not correct. 35.69%. I probably should edit this, but but I won't. I'm going to keep this raw, just so you know that this is difficult stuff. But long story short is that significant increases in tax loads, especially for corporations. So all to say that this is a landmark change. And there's been many commentators, including myself, who are not fans of this. From a tax policy perspective, of course, not happy that we don't have integration. But I also worry about the economic side. We're going to have investors who could otherwise place their dollars in Canada, which has not been a very friendly environment for investors outside of Canada. And even Canadians, for that matter, it's not been a very friendly tax environment. And now, we've had a lot of people historically in the last 6-7 years who have left Canada because of the unfriendly environment. And now with this change as well, just makes it even more unfriendly. And so the short story is I worry about the flight of capital. And if my phone calls and emails and texts and meetings in the last 6 days are in any indication of what we can expect, I do worry about what's going to happen here. So all to say that we have, more issues here to think about. For example, are we going to have to think about crystallizing or triggering gains prior to the, implementation date of June the 25th? And I think the short answer is yes, you're going to have to think about that in the right circumstances. For individuals who have, gains of less than $250,000 or even future expected gains of $250,000 or less, no, probably no planning. But corporations definitely need to think about it. And this leads to my comments in terms of some of the messaging here and some of the financing comments, which I'll get to as well. So let me read to you what the government said in its budget documents. And this is a quote right in the budget documents. It said, and this, they used this quote, by the way, as support for the implementation of this measure. And I'd encourage you actually to go look at the entire comments because it's quite interesting. the people that write this stuff are not dumb. They know what they're doing. But this particular highlight quote in one paragraph really, really gets me upset. And certainly it's gotten a lot of people upset as well. So it says, next year, 28.5 million Canadians are not expected to have any capital gains income, and 3 million are expected to earn capital gains below the $250,000 annual threshold. Only 0.13% of Canadians with an average income of 1.4 million are expected to pay more personal income tax on their capital gains in any given year. As a result of this, for 99.87% of Canadians, personal income taxes on capital gains will not increase. And that's the end of the quote. When I read that, I thought, What the hell are they talking about? And they actually supplemented by saying, it's not in that quote that I read, but that 0.13% equals about 40,000 taxpayers. And they're going to ask those 40,000 individual taxpayers, I should make that clear, individual taxpayers, to pay just a little bit more. And so when you actually reflect on how disingenuous and frankly inaccurate that statement is, it really does upset me. And so why is that not true? And before I get to the reasons why it's not true, I can tell you that in the 6 days since the budget has been released to today, I can't tell you how many times either online or in person or on the phone or by text or by email that I've had to, you know, educate Canadians who lapped up that 40,000 or 0.13% statistic. It just automatically assumed it's correct. And to me, that just shows the power of disingenuous messaging and ultimately how, you know, many media in particular and the average Canadian, and I'm not trying to disparage the average Canadian, but, you know, unfortunately, the average Canadian will just assume that what they hear is correct, especially if it's coming from government. And it's not. And so let me give you the reason why that this is garbage, that messaging. It ignores the fact that that, you know, simple statistic of just looking at, you know, how many people report capital gains and how many, you know, have over 250,000. It ignores the fact that there are hundreds of thousands of private corporations that are owned by individuals. And to be fair, the government does say how many private corporations reported capital gains income. And they said that in the budget documents that, you know, only 12.6% will be affected of all corporations. And again, that is disingenuous and garbage. And why? Well, I'll continue on. The reason why it's garbage is because those private corporations who have capital gains, which they'll, you know, over the lifetime of a private corporation, certainly most who build up capital will ultimately invest in something that will grow in value, hopefully, and at some point in time will trigger a capital gain. And because of the way, and they don't get the $250,000 annual phase-in like individuals do, like we've already talked about. But because the way that passive income is taxed in a Canadian-controlled private corporation, and for those tax geeks who are listening, you'll know that what I'm talking about is the refundable tax on hand regime, which basically is Canada's way of trying to preserve integration by charging a tax inside the corporation that is refundable to the shareholders when taxable dividends are paid out. And basically, what that does is reduces the tax on passive income to a lower level, or just to a level that ultimately, when you combine that with the personal tax on taxable dividends, when you flow the monies out to shareholders, it should equal or come close to what the overall tax would have been had that capital gain or other passive income been realized personally. And across Canada, integration is not perfect. In other words, it's usually you'll pay more on a combined basis if the asset is held corporately, but it's close. It's not perfect, but it's close. In this way now, we have integration that is being thrown out of whack. And so will the impact of this capital gains inclusion rate be felt by all those private corporations in the by way of increased corporate tax and increased taxation on dividends on a combined basis? Yes. And that to me is the highlight, the highlight thing that people need to consider, because by saying that only 0.13% are going to be affected or only 12.6 corporations, that is just simply reporting how many report capital gains at the individual level of the corporations. It doesn't account for the overall impact by way of distributions from the corporation. And so that to me is very disingenuous. And what about public corporations who have capital gains? Well, now automatically they're going to pay corporate tax on a two-thirds inclusion rate. And many successful public corporations pay dividends. and they're owned by pension funds. And so if they have more tax to pay, do you think there's less dividends available to be distributed to shareholders, either individually outside of their pension plans or in, you know, inside their pension plans? Of course, there's less to pay. And so that has a direct impact. Some would argue indirect, and sure, fine, whatever. But it has an impact to millions of Canadians who hold shares of public corporations, Canadian public corporations. And, you know, there are millions of Canadians who own a second property, either a cottage type or a rental type property. And many of them own them through private corporations. Many of them own them personally. And it would not be surprising at some point to see them dispose of it with more than $250,000 capital gain. And what about people who die? Well, we're all going to die, as the old saying, death and taxes. And so in those cases, there's a tax event, unless there's rollovers available to surviving spouses or common law partners, which is the most common rollover. But if you die, the general rule is deemed disposition at fair market value of all of your property. And that, in my experience, is usually the largest capital gains triggering event during a person's lifetime. And so in that case, there is a distinct possibility that future deaths will have gains that exceed $250,000 and thus impacted. And then, you know, finally, people who become non-residents of Canada, and certainly there's been a significant increase in the number of people who have become non-residents of Canada over the last 6-7 years, and in particular the last 3 or 4, and I think that trend is going to continue. Those people who become non-residents of Canada are deemed to have disposed of their assets at fair market value, with some exceptions. And in my view, and certainly from what I've seen, distinct possibilities of having gains over $250,000. And so what's the result of all this? Well, one, that messaging is very dishonest, very disingenuous, and very misleading. And it just plays into this current government's playbook, if you want to call it that, of attacking the wealthy and using statistics that are manipulated in order to, you know, play into their messaging. And it's just simply wrong. And in my view, you need to be aware of that. Will we have crystallization planning, especially with corporations, prior to June the 25th? Yes, I think we will. And, you know, as I've written about in my Financial Post piece, which is being released this week, that is simply just wrong. There's a saying an old saying in the investment world, and I have trumpeted this forever, that the tax tail shouldn't wag the investment dog. And, you know, in plain English, in other words, whatever your tax planning shouldn't drive your overall investment decisions. But in this case, we have a government which is encouraging you to put the tax tail ahead of the investment dog, because they're allowing a 10-week period for you to crystallize for individuals and corporations to pay tax at a lower inclusion rate. And to me, that flies in the face of just proper investment planning. And, you know, when you actually look at the numbers associated with this, so right in the budget documents, the government for 2024-25 is projecting a $4.9 billion tax revenue increase as a result of, for corporations, as a result of this monetization, crystallization type planning that will be available until June the 25th. But the next year, the tax revenue is expected to go down to $1.3 billion. So when you actually see those numbers right in front of you, to me, that is highly offensive. Why? Because the government is planning to collect money as a result of this opportunity to crystallize. And literally, they're using this tax opportunity as a way to collect revenues for short-term political benefits. And what do I mean by that last statement? Well, the political benefit, of course, is they can say, as they've done in some of their bragging about the budget, is they've kept the line on deficits to 40 billion or less, and then they back it up with other statistics. Well, when you actually look at how much of this deficit is being held in line, if you want to call it that, as a result of crystallization transactions, just for corporations, is $5 billion. That, to me, is offensive, ladies and gentlemen. And this, in my view, is very disingenuous and very, frankly, not good. All right. So with that, I think I'm going to get off my soapbox here. And, you know, there's a lot of questions about the implementation details and how capital gains inclusion rates will work on loss carrybacks and loss carry forwards. I think a lot of that will be mechanical, by the way, because there is history to deal with stuff like this, as I mentioned early on in the podcast, from, you know, back in the year 2000 and earlier, when they played around with inclusion rates. So that those kinds of mechanics, along with how capital gains reserves will be utilized, and I think a lot of that are just mechanics. What I'm hopeful for is that Canadians wake up to the disingenuous messaging and to these so obvious politics that are going on with this tax measure, and start pushing back and speaking up. We need changes, because this, you know, by putting the tax tail ahead of the investment dog, in my view, it risks Canadians' futures by doing this. On a whole bunch of fronts, not the least of which is the capital gains inclusion rate monetization stuff, you know, some of the poor economics, increasing public debt charges, et cetera, et cetera. So, thank you for listening. And if I can answer any questions, or feel free to reach out to me. You know, actually, I'm going to comment. I've resisted, but I can't help myself. So, some people, in particular economists, have supported this capital gains inclusion rate measure that was announced 6 days ago. And they do so with, you know, newspaper articles or on their social media by saying that, you know, capital gains should be taxed similar to wages. And, you know, like a buck is a buck, as an old tax commission, the Royal Commission on Taxation, said. But the problem with that is that those economists and academics who support higher inclusion rates on the basis of so-called tax equity ignore the real-world investment world. Because if investors are going to pay tax at the same rates as regular employees do, when regular employees don't risk their capital, then in my view, the whole system breaks down. Because investors look at risk. They look at the time value of money and overall, you know, rates of return. And when the risks and the liquidity and time value of money just don't equate, they'll look for other places to place their investment dollars. So if there's any economists, and I will resist the urge to name names, but if there's any economists or academics listening to this podcast, and, you know, if you have the balls to give me a call or send me a note, I'm happy to spend some time with you and show you where the academic world and the theoretical world collides with real life on investment returns and investment assessments, if you want to call it that, and why capital gains inclusion rates might be good in a theoretical world to be increased. A so-called equity world, equity basis, I mean. But in the real world, the investment community just simply doesn't operate that way. And they look at liquidity risk and time value of money. And so with that, I'm going to leave it at that. And I invite you to provide comments and send questions and get involved. Raise your voices if you're as concerned as I am. Thanks very much, everybody. Bye now.
So there you have it. Another episode of In the Mood with Kim G.C. Moody podcast. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I enjoyed doing it. I'm always open to feedback. Please reach out to me at my personal website at kimgcmoody.com. Feel free to sign up to my mailing list for my one-to-one-to-one newsletter, where I comment on one comment on taxation, one comment on leadership, and one comment on economic or public policy matters. And feel free to reach out to me on my LinkedIn account as well. Until next time, Take care. Bye now.